Okay. Marshall, go ahead and call us to order.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Wheelock, Judge Ross, Judge Hallbrooks, the Honorable Sarah I. Wheelock presiding.
Good morning, everyone. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is here today on Thursday, June 26th, 2025. We have four cases on our calendar today, three of which are scheduled for oral argument. As noted, I'm Judge Wheelock. I am presiding over a panel today with Judge Ross and Judge Hallbrooks. We're holding our arguments via Zoom.gov, so I'm going to just talk a little bit about our virtual format. Our oral arguments are recorded by the court and available within about 24 hours on the Court of Appeals website. And for that reason, we ask that you begin your argument by introducing yourself and identifying who your client is in a nice, loud, clear voice. And additionally, our rules prohibit anyone from making a video recording of oral argument unless you've received the court's permission to do so at least 24 hours in advance and agreed to comply with some specific rules. So let's see, let's call the case, the first case on the calendar.
Now calling A250159, Lawrence Merwin Johnson, respondent versus Jackson Ray Sundin, appellant.
Okay, counsel, as you probably know, you will each have 15 minutes for your principal argument, and counsel for appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. There is a clock on the screen. Can you both see that? That is going to be counting down your time there. So that'll reset according to the amount of time you have for your argument. Again, just remember to introduce yourself. And if there's any issues with the technology this morning, please let me know and we'll pause and address that so that we can rectify it. We want to make sure we hear from each of you. When you're not arguing, if you could leave your video on but mute yourself, that would be helpful as well. And with that, I think counsel for appellant, you can begin when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Carmen Carballo and I represent the appellant, Jackson Sundin, in this matter. There are two main issues before the court today. First, whether the district court committed clear error in concluding that Mr. Johnson is the legal owner of the dog, Jane. And second, whether the interest of justice requires vacation of the judgment to afford Mr. Sundin, who litigated this case pro se, a fair trial. The district court's conclusion that Mr. Johnson is the legal owner of the dog, Jane, was clear error because it was not supported by the evidence in the record. District court's conclusion rested on two key factual findings. First, that Mr. Sundin purchased the dog for Mr. Johnson, and second, that Mr. Johnson paid Mr. Sundin back for the full amount of the adoption fee. Both findings are contradicted by the testimony and therefore constitute clear error. Additionally, even if this court finds that these errors do not rise to the level of clear error, this case presents a situation where vacation and remand is warranted in the interest of justice. Reversing this type of case is rare, as it should be, but this mechanism exists so that when circumstances arise that prevent the fair disposition of the case, this court can provide a remedy. Those circumstances exist here. The district court was aware that Mr. Sundin did not understand the full scope of the issues before the court, but it proceeded with the trial regardless. The district court was also
Mr.
aware.
Are you suggesting that the district court improperly proceeded with the trial after your client agreed to that process?
I don't think there was any explicit agreement by my client, Your Honor. Again, he was.
Think
I'm sorry.
there has to be some explicit agreement given the proceeding?
I'm not sure that there has to be explicit agreement, but just responding to your question, I don't think there was any, explicit agreement by my client to proceed. He made it clear to the district court that he did not understand the scope of the issues, was not prepared to present on all of these issues, and the district court did not ask, if he needed more time, if he wanted to consult with an attorney, things that would be reasonable accommodations to a pro se litigant. The district court does have a duty to provide reasonable accommodations to a pro se
So,
litigant.
are you arguing that the district court abuses discretion by failing to continue the matter? And is that issue presented in your brief?
So we're arguing that in the interest of justice, the district court should have either continued the matter or provided some procedural guidance
My
or
question,
commentary.
though, is that have you argued on appeal in your brief that the district court abuses discretion by failing to continue the matter sua sponte?
No, Your Honor, we did not argue that. The standard of review for the accommodations that should be provided to a pro se litigant is not clear.
Agree that that issue is forfeited?
I would not agree that that issue is forfeited because we raised it in the context of the interest of justice and the failure to accommodate a pro se litigant. What I'm saying is that I don't think that the standard of review is necessarily abuse of discretion. That wasn't entirely clear from the case law. I think it's tied to the standard of review is tied to the issue. And so in this case, the standard of review would be the review for interest of justice and or the clear air review for making factual findings.
I did not see anything in the record that would indicate that Mr. Sundin sought any kind of continuance, or clearly he didn't understand the appellate process going to from conciliation court to the district court and what issues were preserved or not. But I didn't see any confusion with respect to, how he presented his evidence, other than he didn't have the documents that he wished to have, and yet there was sufficient testimony, it seemed to me, about those things.
So he sought to include his documents as exhibits. He didn't file them in advance following the deadline because, again, he didn't know that these issues were even before the district court. What happened was he showed up to district court with all of the documents that had been provided, prepared, used in conciliation court, which included these documents that he wanted to use as evidence.
Right.
Respondents' counsel objected to those, saying that he had never seen those documents before, which was not actually true because they were used in conciliation court where respondents' counsel was also present. And the district court didn't provide Mr. Johnson, or excuse me, Mr. Sundin, any accommodation, any guidance
Well, you
on how to
keep,
get.
Ms. Carballo, I want to be very specific, though, as Judge Ross was attempting to be, because the phrasing is very general. I didn't see any real instance where an accommodation was requested that was denied. I mean, it seems you're arguing it was entirely incumbent upon the judge to handle this situation in a way that would have either been a continuance or, something else. Because for me, reading the record, the contents of those exhibits, those were in evidence in essence. I mean, people talked about them. The two parties talked about the adoption agreement and, other sorts of things that were at issue here. Isn't that true?
That is true, Your Honor. The parties did discuss the agreement and did discuss the veterinary records. But again, being a pro se litigant, testifying off the cuff on an issue that you're not prepared for, I don't think that the district court had all of the relevant evidence that was contained in those documents before it. And I think that's really evident from the fact that the main difference between the conciliation court hearing and the district court hearing was the level of preparation and the fact that these documents were in evidence in conciliation court, but were not in evidence before the district court. And that key difference led to two completely opposite conclusions on
How
this
should
issue.
we treat our case law from the Supreme Court and this court, repeatedly advising the public that unrepresented parties will be treated as if they are represented? The rules will apply the same. They're expected when they choose to proceed without an attorney that they can operate without an attorney. It sounds like you're asking for different treatment in this case, based upon your client's represented, non-represented status.
So it's true that appellant, or excuse me, pro se litigants are held to the same standard as represented parties, but it is also true at the same time that district courts have a duty, and that's language from this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court, to accommodate pro se litigants in some small ways. And
How
that
was
includes.
your client not accommodated? It
He
sounds like
wasn't a.
You're asking for the district court to do more than to accommodate, but to actually proceed on behalf of your client as if the court was your client's attorney, moving and then granting sua sponte a motion to continue.
I think, Your Honor, that Having a pro se litigant show up to court and completely misunderstand what is before the court warrants a continuance, regardless of the fact that my client didn't understand that that was an option to request. But even without the continuance issue, I think the district court understood that there was this key documentary evidence on the issue of ownership. It understood some of what might be in there, and it had a duty to at least allow Mr. John or Mr. Sundin to respond to the objection, if not, provide some procedural guidance regarding how to get those documents in, if it was possible to get those documents in despite missing the deadline. It provided no accommodation of any kind regarding those documents. And it even
Given you only have 6 or 7 minutes remaining and you have other arguments to get to, it might be in your best interest to move on to those.
I just
Thank you,
have
Your Honor.
one before we leave this in the interest of justice issue, Ms. Carvalho. I was frankly offended by the fact that in the reply brief, you inserted a new argument in support of this, saying that the district court was surprisingly hostile to Mr. Sundin. This was the first time that statement appeared. There was no indication of that in your presentation of that issue in your primary brief. What in the record supports hostility on the part of the court here?
I think that the district court's overall demeanor was hostile toward my client, and I'm not sure that
Well,
it's.
you were not present, correct?
I was not present, correct.
Can you point us, going to Judge Hallbrook's question, quote for us the portion of the record that supports your accusation against the district court?
I would say at addendum 11, it says if the dog was originally awarded to you in the underlying one, you are the one that made that decision by requesting trial de novo. Again, with the context that my client did not understand that was happening, and I don't think it's entirely clear that all of the issues would have been before the court to a pro se litigant. It also said, the court also said, when you should have noted that the district court, or excuse me, that the court issued an order vacating it. If you didn't understand vacating, you could have looked up the word, which means it's no longer enforceable. It's no longer existing. And then when my client attempted to enter those documents into evidence or state that he had these documents as exhibits, the district court said, well, we'll deal with it when we get to Mr. Sundin's testimony. And then it never reprised that issue. Despite asking questions sua sponte on other issues, the court knew that this evidence existed and just never tried to give any sort of accommodation or any sort of chance for my client to even respond to the objection or bring these documents to light.
Besides
Are you
the
alleging
standard.
there was judicial misconduct here? I don't see that in your argument. No, Your Honor, we're not alleging that there was judicial misconduct. My phrasing of hostility, apologies that it was offensive, it was sort of to get the point across that normally when a pro se litigant appears in court, judges are typically somewhat accommodating as they have a duty to be. And here that just seemed to be,
You're
you messed
suggesting
up, too bad, so sad.
You're suggesting that this judge acted in a way that was not typical in reference to pro se parties. What's your basis for that accusation?
My basis for that accusation are the case law that states that a district court has a duty to accommodate a pro se litigant and the case law
No,
that.
your statement was that the district court in this case acted atypically. And I'm wondering what the basis for that accusation is.
In the case law, there's many examples of a pro se litigant appearing and being afforded some kind of accommodation. And my comment about atypicality is that the district court didn't provide any kind of accommodation to this pro se litigant or provide, show any understanding of why the appellant showed up to the trial without fully understanding the issues that were before the court.
If I can be frank, your accusation that the district court was hostile, and the district court was acting atypical, I think you've provided the same amount of support for each accusation, which is frankly none. But you have other arguments you should probably proceed to.
Understood, Your Honor. And again, that might be a mischaracterization or a poor language choice, but
It's a
it's more
miscarriage.
to contextualize.
You're going to accuse a district court judge bias or hostility or improper treatment, you should support it with actual citation to the record, actual citation to authority. You haven't.
Respectfully, Your Honor, we did not accuse the district court of showing any bias. That was not an argument we raised, and we did that intentionally because we don't think there was bias. And so, again, my language is
I'm
more
sorry, you
characterizing the proceedings.
hostility and atypical, those are the two claims that you've made. I think neither of them is supported, but you've got a couple of minutes left. You have other argument. I think it's that's more substantive that you should get to.
I should, Your Honor.
Turn to that substantive argument, if we could, for a moment, because given the standard of review that this case is here on, you've made arguments that there's clear error in the factual findings. And the factual finding that I'm concerned with is factual finding number five, that the parties agree that the dog was purchased on your client's card because the other party did not have a credit card, but that they in fact did agree that the person who purchased it would be paid back, and that the person did in fact pay them back. And that's based in part on testimony, both from the respondent here, who explained his practice of paying in cash to replenish, to pay back, reimburse his then partner for purchases, but also from your client's statement, I believe, in the record at addendum page 33, that where he says, "I don't recall getting cash for the dog, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen." And so I guess my question is, is there something else in the record that shows that, in fact, this was clear error? Because with that kind of an equivocal statement that, well, it could have happened, that in fact that he paid me back, and I'm just wondering what, if you can address that portion of your argument, please.
Yes, Your Honor. The evidence in the record doesn't support this finding because there's nothing that clearly states that Mr. Johnson paid the full amount of the adoption fees. Mr. Sundin testified that he paid the full amount of the fee associated with adopting and caring for Jane and didn't recall Mr. Johnson giving any cash to him for Jane's adoption fees. And, you know, the parties were together for a number of years.
Oh,
This
hold on. Please make sure you're characterizing the record correctly. Didn't your client say, "I don't recall getting cash for her from him, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen"?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think the more relevant part of his statement is the first half, that he doesn't recall it happening. Again, I understand that he stated that doesn't mean it did not
Why isn't
happen.
the, since we look at the facts and the evidence in the light most favorable to the district court's conclusion and draw inferences in favor, why isn't the second half of that statement, what's the one that you failed to quote, actually the one that's most relevant? But it doesn't mean it didn't happen. Doesn't that acknowledge that your client was informing the district court or implying to the district court that, in fact, it may have happened exactly as Mr. Johnson testified?
It acknowledges the possibility of it happening, and that, you know, it was an effort on my client's part as a pro se litigant to be extremely candid with the court and to testify as one, you know, normally speaks rather than someone who has an attorney and is, you know, practicing their testimony. But I would say that it doesn't support a finding that Mr. Johnson did pay the fee, because Mr. Johnson himself, his testimony does not establish that he paid the entire fee. And again, the parties had a practice between themselves of paying some fees between themselves, splitting expenses, which is acknowledged in Mr. Johnson's brief. But there's nothing in the record that states that he paid the entire $900. In fact, Mr. Johnson's testimony states that we paid $900, which implies or infers the court, or implies or states to the court that the parties both contributed to the fees, the full $900 fee.
Counsel, your
Well,
time is up. Judge Ross, would you like to continue?
just to, again, in the interest of being clear on the record, I think Mr. Johnson's testimony was, "We paid about $900 for her." You're correct, it's "we paid." And then the next statement, though, he paid for it out of his credit card, but I gave him cash to pay for it, just like everything else.
Yes, Your Honor. That statement doesn't specify the amount of cash he paid. And again, the testimony establishes that, and Johnson's brief establishes that, the parties had a practice of splitting expenses. So If someone paid the full amount and then was given cash, I think it implies that the amount of cash that was given was perhaps half. But nowhere in the record does it very clearly establish that Mr. Johnson paid the entire amount.
Okay, seeing no further questions at this point, we're going to turn to counsel for respondent. So let's see, the 15 minutes has been reset on the clock. And please recall that I've asked you to introduce yourself and the name of your client. You may indicate any requested pronouns at that time to be used, and you may begin when you are ready.
Your Honors, is my connection good? Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Excellent. So my name is John Schulte. I am with the Hanfreddy Law Firm in Duluth, Minnesota. And my client is the respondent in this matter, Mr. Lawrence Johnson, who did waive his ability to be present this morning for oral arguments. I think this is a very straightforward and factually simple matter that frankly, I probably wouldn't need an entire 15 minutes to argue our position.
Can we just clarify, Mr. Schulte, at the beginning, because you include in your brief a dispute about the ownership of the canoe, but you did not file any type of notice of appeal with respect to that, correct?
We did not, I guess, because the issue of the dog was appealed so quickly and this matter was going to be before the Court of Appeals. I did not separately file a separate notice of appeal on that issue, acknowledging I did include it in my brief.
So do you concede that issue is not before this panel?
Reluctantly, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Can you go? I have a question for you on the merits.
Certainly.
I had just been speaking with Ms. Carballo on one of the statement of your client, and I'd like to hear you expound upon how you believe it should be interpreted for our purposes on appeal. He paid for it with his credit card, but I gave him cash to pay for it, just like everything else. So why doesn't the just like everything else qualify the statement about the payment to mean it was a shared cost divided in half?
I think because, Your Honor, the testimony regarding Jane the dog was so factually specific, the exact cost, $900, was recited by my client, that the testimony was Mr. Sundin paid for the dog, and then Mr. Johnson reimbursed Mr. Sundin for the cost of the dog. And he seemed very clear and specific on this point, which kind of brings me back around to obviously the main argument, or one of the main arguments I make in our brief. And that is that the assessment of the credibility of witnesses by both rule and case law is obviously, and has to be, uniquely within the purview of the district court. And Judge Friday here listened to the testimony of both parties, including the statement that you pointed out about that doesn't mean it didn't happen, and found correctly, or at least well within the district's discretion, that it was Mr. Johnson who in fact paid for Jane. And that was obviously one of the primary underpinnings of the judge's ruling, that Mr. Johnson is the rightful owner of Jane. If that addresses your question.
It does. Would you agree that one might infer, one might interpret your client's statement, just like everything else, to mean that the parties divided the cost of the dog equally and that the payment was only for half?
That would be one interpretation, but that was not the interpretation that the district court came to after carefully listening to everything and assessing all the evidence. And again, I think that ruling was well within the discretion based on the testimony as it was presented at the hearing back in September. Should I continue?
It's up to you. That was my only question.
Okay, I just didn't know if there were any other questions.
No follow-up. Right. I don't have any follow-up questions.
In sort of her opening remarks, Ms. Carballo specifically said that the Court of Appeals overturning or remanding a case such as this is rare. And again, it's rare for a reason, because these types of determinations are clearly meant to be within the purview of the district court. In her brief, Ms. Carballo, on behalf of her client, sort of repeatedly states that this that there was testimony that was inconsistent, and that somehow rendered my client not credible, and the court should not have found him credible. Specifically, emphasizing again and again this notion of whether Jane was in fact a service dog. My client's testimony was completely credible on that point and consistent, that Jane never had any formal training to be determined to be a service dog, but sort of helped act in that capacity for my client, who does have some challenges and is partially disabled and functionally illiterate, as he testified to, and has a lot of mental health things that he said, this is why Jane helped me with these things, and this is why Jane was so invaluable to these things, but clearly acknowledges that we never did go to the certification level where Jane could go into stores with him, because they didn't really need to do that, because he didn't have that many occasions to enter stores or anything such as that. So I guess more broadly speaking, this notion that there was this testimony that somehow was inconsistent and should render my client's entire testimony found not to be credible, or the finding that he was a credible witness was erroneous, is just not, I think, borne out here by the record in any real respect. And the ultimate conclusion reached by the court in a personal property dispute that Jane was my client's dog, I think is very well supported by the evidence and the record.
Mr. Schulte, could you respond to Ms. Carballo's argument that these exhibits that were in evidence at the conciliation court hearing, specifically the veterinary records, I'm trying to think of the other two. I mean, there were some very specific things that Mr. Sundin felt supported his claim of ownership. You apparently made the statement you had not seen them before, but setting that aside, they didn't get formally admitted in the before the district court, correct?
That is correct. And I would further note that when Mr. Sundin said he wasn't objecting to my exhibits in the preliminary opening of the trial and they were accepted, and I said that I would be raising an objection, the judge did not specifically say he was excluding them at that point. He said, we'll come back to them during your testimony. And then during Mr. Sundin's testimony, he never made any further attempt to offer those exhibits, as he had every ability to do, and as the court had kind of told him at the beginning, he would give him the opportunity to do. They just sort of never came up again. And, you know, I obviously recognize that Mr. Sundin was representing himself, but he chose to do that. And I think sort of the inquiry that was made by your honors during Ms. Carballo's argument, there is nothing here that the district court abused any discretion or crossed any lines in its treatment of Mr. Sundin. Mr. Sundin was given a full chance to testify, to cross-examine my client, to tell the court what he wanted to tell the court. And I think it's very important, absolutely could have asked for a continuance, could have very early in the life of that hearing said, oh, wait, the dog is at issue. Judge, I'm sorry, I didn't understand that. Could we please come back another time?
Now, one way to look at the evidentiary issue is that Mr. Sundin was in fact offering the exhibits, and then the district court didn't rule on the admission, and then never ruled on the admission, but should have. Why is that an improper way to interpret what happened?
Well, I think it's an improper way to interpret what happened, because the judge specifically instructed him to sort of bring that issue up again when he was presenting his case in chief, and he never did bring it up again. So I think that would be my answer to that.
Well, normally, you know, you would not be able to testify about the contents of an exhibit that wasn't in evidence. But my impression here was, and I correct me if I'm wrong, was that that actually occurred here, that there was testimony from one, if not both parties, about contents of these exhibits.
I don't know if I'd say the testimony was necessarily specifically regarding contents of the exhibits, meaning on such and such a date we went to the
Well, I
vet
don't mean
and
that,
that
but
was
like
this.
I paid for the veterinary care of Jane, that type of thing.
I guess I would describe that more, Your Honor, in the nature of just general testimony about the party's financial practices, which certainly has been a topic of both that hearing and this hearing, that my client, again, is unsophisticated, did not have a debit card, did not have a bank account in his name, operated on solely a cash basis. I guess he had a bank account because you're for Social Security, you have to, but he would just take cash out and then would reimburse Mr. Sundin when Mr. Sundin would make purchases. So I guess I would characterize that testimony more as general testimony as to the nature of the party's practice, as opposed to specific testimony about the contents of things like veterinary records, training records, things of that nature. But I guess so, going back to the argument I was making, that the district court here, I think, was very reasonable and fair in its approach to what occurred. Rule 521 of the General Rules of Procedure pertaining to conciliation court proceedings is crystal clear as to what the ramifications are of appealing a ruling from the conciliation court to the district court. It is trial de novo. That means all of the issues are back before the court, and it is if the conciliation court case never happened. And Judge Friday, from the beginning, made that very clear. And again, Mr. Sundin could have had every ability to go, "Whoa, Judge, can we come back? Can we continue this then? I'm going to need some more time." He did not do that. He said he was fine going forward. And again, and the judge even said, "I'll let you tell me about Jane," kind of in the context of that, what the exhibit said. And I know the unintroduced exhibits, and I know we already addressed that. And Mr. Sundin didn't really push back or say, "No, I'm not comfortable doing that." He's aware that he had a right to counsel throughout the course of these proceedings. He has to be held to some standard of being aware of the repercussions of the decisions he made throughout the course of what has become very drawn out litigation. He chose to appeal from the conciliation court. My client may have, because of the ruling on Jane, we received that notice of appeal before we ever had the chance to make a final decision on that issue. But again, once he made that decision, everything was properly back in front of the district court, and the district court correctly held a hearing that addressed all of those issues. I'll note an in-person hearing. It wasn't even a Zoom hearing. We all drove to Virginia. Everybody got up on the witness stand. It was very thorough. It lasted roughly an hour. The court gave everybody a chance to say everything that they felt was important. And again, made a ruling that I think was well within the broad discretion of the district court in assessing the testimony and correctly deciding that Jane the dog belongs to Mr. Johnson. And so I guess with that, I don't have any further argument. So if there's no other questions, I would wield the final 2 minutes of my time.
I'm not seeing any other questions, so thank you, Mr. Schulte, for your argument. We'll have the clock reset for 5 minutes, and we'll turn back to Ms. Carballo for a brief response.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to touch on the procedural challenges that Mr. Sundin faced here. As Mr. Schulte pointed out, he could have requested a continuance, but as a pro se litigant, he does not know that a continuance is a possibility. He doesn't know the word continuance. He would not know that that's something he could request. And he was trying to be respectful and was obviously caught unaware that these issues were going to be before the court. He stated very clearly that he was aware that he was not aware that this issue was even before the court. And the court said, "I understand that. We're going to proceed anyway." Something to that effect. I'm not quoting directly from the transcript. I can find a quote. Additionally, the documents that were not entered into evidence contained key ev or that were not entered as exhibits contained key evidence about the issue of ownership that was before the court. It was the only unbiased evidence that clearly established payment, as well as there was an agreement within the adoption agreement that Mr. Sundin was adopting Jane solely for himself and would not sell, give her away, adopt her out, or give her to anyone else in the process of adopting her. This, along with uncontradicted testimony, directly undermines the district court's finding that Mr. Sundin was purchasing Jane for Mr.
Carballo,
Johnson.
it wasn't disputed that your client paid the vet bill, was it?
No, Your Honor, it was not.
Okay, so I think that maybe then changes the value of or the impact that not having the bill in the record would have here.
That's a fair point, Your Honor. I would just say that his statement, the statement in the agreement that Mr. John or Mr. Sundin specifically was adopting Jane for himself and would not be giving her to any other party was really key here. And that is what the court found, actually, that Mr. Sundin was adopting Jane for Mr. Johnson. This is the key finding that is tied to the finding of ownership because, of course, if Mr. Sundin was adopting Jane for Mr. Johnson, then he would expect that Mr. Johnson would pay back the fee in full. But that's not supported by the record. That's actually contradicted by the testimony of both parties, where both parties stated that Mr. Johnson did not want a dog. Mr. Sundin wanted the dog. Mr. Johnson was hesitant, and that it was
But there's
only
also
later that.
testimony from Mr. Johnson that because of his past experience, he was reluctant to get a dog, but that he extracted some type of promise from Mr. Sundin that, if they were to get a dog, that he would never take the dog from him, from Mr. Johnson. So I just think you're presenting the testimony in this black and white, clear fashion that was not what was the district court's experience here. And I just want to have you address. Because the one thing that surprised me, you were really, the district court made specific credibility findings here, found both parties credible. And then, and there was a lot of testimony about, things that were promised and that sort of thing. And then ultimately, of course, awarded Jane to Mr. Johnson. You are really asking us to substitute our judgment on credibility in this matter. Which, of course, is not something we do here. And I looked at the sources, the authority you provided for that argument, and I don't think they support it. Could you please respond to that?
Yes, Your Honor. We're not asking this court to substitute its finding of credibility or any of its factual findings. What we're asking this court to do is very carefully parse the testimony and the evidence that was in the record and consider the evidence that was not able to be in the record under the interests of justice and understand that the findings that the district court made were sort of these broad sweeps of the testimony without really looking at the individual pieces of testimony that don't support these findings. I mean, specifically, I couldn't find any support anywhere that Mr. Johnson or Mr. Sundin was adopting the dog for Mr. Johnson. And that is a finding that the district court made in the exact same paragraph where it concluded that legal ownership belonged to Mr. Johnson here. One more issue that I would like to touch on is a clarification on Mr. Schulte's characterization that I stated it was rare for the court to overturn cases. My statement was more that it was rare to utilize Rule 103.04 to overturn cases, and we understand and recognize that. But if we zoom out here, there is a right answer. There's a correct answer as to who owned Jane. And the best way to find that answer is by holding a trial where all of the parties are prepared to litigate that specific issue. All of the parties have their relevant evidence that the district court can consider, and then the court can come to a proper finding because, again, the evidence was in the record at the conciliation court and then was not at the district court, and that resulted in a complete switch on this issue.
Okay. Well, thank you to both counsel. I just want to take a moment and say thank you for the briefing and for argument here today. The case is submitted and a decision will be issued within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay.